This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If Zionist Theodore Herzl and singer Janis Joplin had a child together, it would have been Zev Chafetz. That's how Thomas Friedman described my guest, Zev Chafetz, in the bestseller From Beirut to Jerusalem. Chafetz is an Israeli who grew up in Pontiac, Michigan. He was the director of the Israeli government press office under Prime Minister Menachem Begin. He's also known in Israel for having the first Hebrew doo-wop hit. Chafetz now writes a lively and opinionated political column in the new magazine The Jerusalem Report, which he also edits. His book Double Vision offered a critical analysis of Western press coverage of the Middle East. His book Heroes and Hustlers, Hard Hats and Holy Men was about the new generation of Israelis. Now he's completed his first novel, Inherit the Mob. It's about a Pulitzer Prize-winning American reporter whose late uncle was one of the last old-time Jewish gangsters. We'll talk about the novel a little later. First, let's get a sense of what Chafetz thinks of his country's decision to attend the Middle East Peace Conference.
I think, like most Israelis, I have mixed emotions about it. It's something that we've wanted for a long time. And like many things that you've wanted for a long time, when you get it, you become suspicious of it. But on the whole, I'm glad that we're going, and I'm mildly optimistic that something will come out of it.
You said you wanted it for a long time. I guess that means wanted to sit around the table with representatives of the Palestinians and the Arab countries. Did you want it under the circumstances that you're getting it?
Well, you know, we were spoiled in a way by Anwar Sadat of Egypt, whose peace initiative was so warm-hearted and so demonstrative and so evidently heartfelt that it became the model for how we envisioned other Arab leaders coming forward. And what we're seeing now, both on the Israeli side and especially on the Arab side, is a sort of grudging march to the table under American pressure. And it's not really what we sort of thought of when we were looking at the Sadat model.
Well, do you think it's possible to have anything come out of talks where all the parties seem to be coming kind of reluctantly under pressure?
Well, it appears that all of us have the same motivation in one way. That is, none of us wants to be blamed for being the recalcitrant party. And that's really been the primary motivator for getting people to the table. On the Israeli side, since Israel is the only one of the negotiating countries which is a democracy, the impact of domestic public opinion is going to be crucial regarding whether Israel stays in the talks or not. And that means that the Arab partners on the other side are going to have to convince a large segment of the Israeli public, those in the middle and those on the moderate right, that it's worth staying and it's worth talking. If they don't do that, then I think the government will be under a lot of pressure to break off the talks when the going gets rough.
Well, what are the circumstances under which you think Israel might walk?
Well, if Israel comes to the conference and finds that it's really nothing more than an international forum or kind of a kangaroo court to force it to make unilateral territorial concessions, then I think that it would be under a lot of pressure to get up and leave the conference. The Americans sold this conference on the basis that it was the beginning of a true reconciliation between Israel and the Arab world. And one of the elements in that were the regional talks, in other words, the talks between Israel and all of the Arab countries on water rights and on disarmament and other things, economic cooperation and those things which would signal an acceptance of Israel in the area. If that doesn't happen, and pretty soon, I think that it would be very hard for an Israeli delegation to remain in the talks.
Do you support land for peace, and would you support a two-state solution?
Well, I support some land for real peace. I think that it would be extraordinarily dangerous for us to give up the Golan Heights unless we had the most ironclad kinds of assurances, both about demilitarization and also about Syria's future intentions and the shape of any future Syrian administration. The Gaza Strip, as far as I'm concerned, and I think most Israelis, can go to anybody who wants it. The West Bank, which is probably the most complex of those issues, is not, I don't think, going to be able to be given up at this stage. There are 160,000 Israelis living there. But creative diplomacy could probably find some way to satisfy the Arab territorial demands without requesting that these Israeli cities be uprooted.
So do you think that there should be a Palestinian state?
No, on that I'm in agreement with the government of Israel and the government of the United States. I don't think that there ought to be an independent Palestinian state between Israel and Jordan. I think it would be both too geographically constrained, and also it would be a permanent barrier to normal relations. The Palestinians, after all, have been and remain on the side of the radicals in the Middle East, and it would be very discomforting for us to face an Arafat-led Palestinian state within rifle distance of the Israeli capital.
I don't know if you saw it yesterday, but Tom Friedman in the New York Times had a news analysis piece on the peace talks. And he said that pressing for peace in the Middle East could actually destabilize the area. His points were that the balance of power in the Middle East has evolved. Now, it's not quite peace that you have there. On the other hand, it isn't war. And he points out that the Gulf War wasn't really to establish real peace. It was to restore the balance of power. It even left Saddam Hussein in power when the war was over. Do you agree with him that pressing for, quote, real peace in the Middle East could actually destabilize the area?
Well, that's like saying that the fall of communism could destabilize Eastern Europe. Obviously, any time that there's a change, and in this case, peace would be certainly a positive change, you run the risk of short-term destabilization. The situation that we have and that Tom, who's a good friend, wrote about, I think, correctly yesterday, seems more bearable from the perspective of the New York Times op-ed page than it is from the perspective of Israel. It's fair to say that we aren't really in a state of war, but you would have been hard-pressed to prove that last January, February, when we were being shot at with Scud missiles. And so I'm all in favor of destabilizing the present impasse if what comes in its place is some kind of a more amiable relationship between us and our neighbors.
Let's talk a little bit about your background. You had been the head of the government press office under Menachem Begin from 77 to 82. You were head of the press office.
Right.
Why did you end up leaving?
Well, I came into that job about 6 weeks before Sadat came to Egypt, and so I had the honor and the pleasure of being involved in a very small way in the peace process, and that, of course, was something that I'll probably be very happy to tell my grandchildren about. I left during the war in Lebanon in 1982 in September, and the reason that I left was because I found myself in essential disagreement with the government's policies. And since I had a job which required me to explain and defend Israeli policy, I didn't feel that it would be fair to the government or fair to myself to continue.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Zev Chaifetz. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Zev Chaifetz is my guest. He's an American-born Israeli writer. He directed the Israeli government press office from 77 to 82. He now edits the news magazine The Jerusalem Report, which just completed its first year. And he's also the author of the new novel Inherit the Mob, about the nephew of one of the last of the old-time Jewish gangsters. And we'll talk about this new novel a little later in our talk. You came to Israel from the United States in 1967. I think you were still in college when you went to Israel.
Yes, I was an undergrad at the University of Michigan.
Yeah, why'd you go to Israel? What first attracted you there? And did you didn't plan to stay, right?
No, I went just for a year, you know, a junior year abroad.
Mm-hmm.
It was the 60s, and everybody was going someplace, and I thought that Israel would be an interesting place to try. I had never been there and hadn't really thought much about it before. And when I got there, I arrived within a couple of weeks of the Israeli victory in the Six-Day War. And the contrast between coming from the campus in Ann Arbor, where anti-Vietnam feeling and really sort of anti-patriotic sentiments were so strong, and also the terrible riot that took place in the city of Detroit just a few days before I left Michigan, to a country like Israel, where everyone was euphoric and very patriotic and very upbeat, was extremely attractive to me. And as I was there for a while, I became attracted by other things, by the historical romance of being in a country which was reborn just about the same time that I was born, and also by some trivial things. I liked the weather. I liked the informality. And so one way or another, I decided to stay on for a while, and in a while became 25 years, and I'm still there.
Was it different for you to learn Hebrew when you got to Israel than it was to learn Hebrew for your bar mitzvah when you were 13?
Well, yeah. I mean, when I learned Hebrew for my bar mitzvah, what I did was, you know, I just memorized the sounds, you know, from a record. And I was able to spout those back, and I promptly forgot every single syllable about 5 minutes after the ceremony. Learning Hebrew when I got to Israel was an act of survival. I mean, I realized that I'd better learn how to speak Hebrew, or I wouldn't be able to function there. And of course, I was immersed in the country. I spent several years in the army, and by the time I got out of the army, I was speaking Hebrew.
Did you become any more or less observant Jew in Israel?
You mean religiously?
Religiously, yeah.
No, I was never a particularly observant Jew in the United States, and I have become probably less so in Israel. Some of my attitudes about religion are colored by the role of religion in Israeli politics, which I find unpleasant and bothersome. And so from time to time, I have written in the Jerusalem Report, I write a weekly column there, and I've written some, I think, quite critical things about the Orthodox establishment in Israel, which haven't been appreciated by the Orthodox establishment. I hope they're appreciated by some of the readers of the magazine. And I certainly haven't become more observant. I think of Israel as one big open-air synagogue with lots of rooms in it, including a sanctuary for the people who want to pray, but plenty of other sorts of rooms as well. And I tend to spend most of mine in the social hall or the temple kitchen.
We know you mentioned some of the critical things you've written in your column about the ultra-Orthodox. Let me quote a recent column. You wrote, "The black hats belong to a strange and hostile cult. They teach their own children that we are Gentiles, to be scorned and avoided. They present themselves as the real Jews. They have more in common with Bible-thumping Christian fundamentalists or hysterical Islamic fanatics than to any real Jewishness." Have you gotten a lot of criticism within Israel for that?
No, in Israel, it's funny, you know, in Israel, the discourse is very sharp. We're used to talking to one another at the tops of our lungs. And since the rabbis, the ultra-Orthodox rabbis, have set themselves up as clubhouse politicians, they're fair game for criticism by people like me who don't like that variety of politics. I got a tremendous amount of criticism abroad, in the United States, in England, and other places where the Jerusalem Report is sold, because people in these countries are much less used to hearing that kind of tone, disrespectful tone, and it was intentionally disrespectful, used toward ultra-Orthodox rabbis or other religious figures.
Now, you worked for the Begin government as the head of the government press office. I mean, Begin was a very conservative prime minister. Were your politics as conservative in the United States as they were considered when you got to Israel, were you positioned differently politically in America than in Israel?
Well, I don't know. I think the political positioning is sometimes oversimplified in the United States. Begin's domestic policies, were he an American president, would have put him to the left of Teddy Kennedy. He favored everything from affirmative action to open immigration to extremely populistic economic policies. Begin was not a conservative. He was a hawk. And he was also very determined to hold on to all of the land of Israel. I never shared that kind of an ideological determination to hold on to all of the land of Israel. I thought that for security reasons, we ought to try it until there was a change in the Arab world. But I certainly appreciated Begin's hawkishness. Now, in America, I wasn't a hawk on Vietnam because I didn't think that the war in Vietnam was a sensible war. But I certainly thought, for example, that Begin's destruction of the Iraqi nuclear reactor in 1981, which was condemned by American liberals as being a terrible act of aggression, was an act of enormous courage and fantastic foresight. And in fact, if it weren't for Begin having done that in 1981, I wouldn't be talking to you, at least not from this world. We'd all be dead. And so since the context was different, I suppose that my political positioning was different. Begin also, and in this he may be different from his successor, Mr. Shamir, was capable, despite his ideology, of considerable flexibility. It was Begin, after all, who agreed to give back the entire Sinai for peace with Egypt. I'm not sure that Mr. Shamir, who was opposed to that, would today, if he were offered a similar deal, agree to it.
In the best-selling book From Beirut to Jerusalem, Tom Friedman of the New York Times spends several pages talking about you, and he describes you like this. If Theodore Herzl and Janis Joplin had a child together, it would have been Zev. How do you like that?
Well, that just proves that Friedman doesn't know anything about rock and roll, which I could have told him even before he wrote the book. I would have taken Etta James as my mother and not Janis Joplin. The Herzl part is all right. Tom is a terrific writer, and he's very good at these sort of clever characterizations, and that one will probably follow me around for the rest of my life.
Do you miss rock and roll in Israel? Is there enough good stuff for you there?
Well, we have had some fun with that. You know, when I got to Israel in 67, we were still in the accordion age. In fact, the first, I remember I got off the plane and the first song that I heard when I got on the bus was On the Baby's Knuckle or the Baby's Knee, Where Will the Baby's Dimple Be? And I think that's Doris Day. And I almost got off the bus and went home to Detroit. It was a very frightening experience. But we have progressed since then. We've come a long way. And I've had a—I must say, if there's anything I'm proud of in my 25 years in Israel, it's the very modest role that I've played as a rock and roll pioneer. I was the co-author of the first and, I think, only Hebrew doo-wop song.
Now you're going to have to sing us a chorus of it.
Never.
Oh,
I didn't say
on.
I was the singer. I was just the songwriter. But because things were so wide open, we've been able to do some things, some experimental things, which have been great fun. And, of course, now Israel is getting hooked up to world cable television like everybody else, and so you can watch MTV. And I suppose that my 9-year-old son, Shmulik, will probably grow up singing the lyrics to the latest American songs, just like all the other kids in the world.
Zev Chafetz, let's get to your new novel. It's called Inherit the Mob, and it's about a Pulitzer Prize-winning newspaper reporter whose uncle is a big Jewish mobster, and when the uncle dies, he bequeaths some of his estate, which is his illegitimate businesses, to the nephew, so the nephew inherits the mob. Why were you interested in Jewish gangsters?
Well, I once wrote a book called Members of the Tribe, which was a trip I took through American Jewish life. Exotic characters. And I ran into a guy in Detroit named Maxie Silk, who is now in his 80s and long since gone good. But when he was young, was one of these Damon Runyon-esque Jewish gangsters in Detroit. And Maxie, I was fascinated by his stories and also by the way he talks. He's the last person in the world who speaks Damon Runyon as a first language. And I listened to the rhythms of it, and I listened to the stories about it, and I gradually became interested in that little subculture of Jewish life, which when I was growing up was repressed because nobody, you know, when you got a book for your bar mitzvah, you know, you think that the only Jews who ever lived were Einstein and Freud and a couple of other geniuses and Hank Greenberg. And, you know, we discovered that here were all these guys, you know, Dutch Schultz and Lepke Buckhalter and Lansky and so forth. That we had never been told about. And so I became interested, and I see that the interest is not just mine. I mean, there's been a proliferation in the last couple of years of books and movies. A friend of mine, Robert Lacey, just has a book out now on Mayor Lansky, and there's I see that they're making a movie of Billy Bathgate, which is about Dutch Schultz. So I think that there's an interest among a growing number of people in this, you know, fascinating and somewhat secretive cult of Jewish gangsters.
You had described when you first got to Israel that part of the excitement for you was the euphoria and also the patriotism. The United States was going through the Vietnam War, and you were so struck by a country whose people felt so strongly about it. Well, Israel always hasn't always stayed in that kind of euphoric state. There are a lot of divisions in Israel. You had to sit in rooms with gas masks on during the Gulf War. With the euphoria gone, and when Israel is very divided, do those strong feelings always stick with you, the strong feelings about the country?
Well, the feelings have changed, obviously. You're right. Israel is not the euphoric place that it was right after the war in 1967. It's become, I think, a much more realistic country. It's become a much more mature country. And I have the great advantage of having been born only 1 year before Israel. So Israel and I are getting middle-aged together. And so I'm probably a less euphoric person and more realistic in what I expect from a place that I live. And those things which I do expect, Israel has delivered. It's given me a country which I respect and a country which I'm fond of. It's given me a good place to raise two children. A constant stream of excitement. I mean, you wake up in the morning and turn on the news in Israel with an expectation that you don't have any place else. You know, one day it's Scuds falling on you, and the next day it's 30,000 Ethiopian Jews being airlifted to Israel, and the day after that it's the flood of Russians coming in, and there's sort of an endless excitement about being an Israeli. And so those things are positive. I've become cranky like everybody else. There are things that annoy me. There are things that, thank God, because I wouldn't have anything to write about otherwise. But on the whole, I've managed to retain a lot of affection for Israel and a lot of respect for it.
Zev Chafetz, his new novel is Inherit the Mob. His book about Detroit, Devil's Night, just came out in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air,